I would assume you knew, even going in, that the war was coming close to an end.
Yeah, I mean, you could tell when I went in December, January, it was obvious that things were going down the tubes fast because the North Vietnamese were not respecting the treaty, 73 Paris Treaty, which was signed by Kissinger and Lê Duc Tho, and they were just moving across the DMZ at will, huge units, divisions of troops, and everybody knew that they were poised to attack Saigon. So,
when did you get a feeling that, you're leaving Vietnam, or the U.S. leaving Vietnam was going to be imminent?
Around April 1st, I was pretty sure it was going to be happening because I'd talked with a lot of people I'd known in the embassy. Before I was a journalist, when I was in the military, I was in military intelligence, so I had what they call a top secret and crypto clearance, and I told the people in the embassy that. I told the CIA people in the embassy about my background and intelligence work, and that made them trust me. So I would meet them at a bar on Tudor Street. One of these people, a guy named Frank Snepp, who went on to write a book called A Decent Interval, which got him into lots of trouble with the CIA. But he told me the inside scoop, what was happening in the embassy and what they were trying to do and how it was really an untenable situation. And the field stations all throughout Vietnam were sending back messages every day saying, "This looks bad. The North Vietnamese are just rolling south, and nobody's stopping them." And because what had happened after around March 7th, a city. Are we on?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. A city around March 7th, a city called Ban Mae Thuot, which is in the northern highlands, it's a provincial capital. That city fell, and when that happened, I was in Cambodia at the time when that happened because I was covering Cambodia also, and I was in Phnom Penh, and we were dealing with our own situation there because the Khmer Rouge were circling Cambodia and just pelting the city with rockets every day, and it was really miserable. At the point where I saw Ban Mae Thuot had fallen, I decided I'd better get to Vietnam. That's the bigger story for us. So I got a flight. I mean, I actually evacuated out of Phnom Penh and wound up going to Bangkok for about 2 days, and then flew into Saigon from there. And what had happened is after Ban Mae Thuot fell on March 7th, actually between March 7th and March 11th, the president of South Vietnam, President Tu, Nguyen Van Thieu, decided to pretty much cede the northern half of South Vietnam to the North Vietnamese because he knew he couldn't defend it. And that precipitated one of the greatest routs in military history.
What were they doing in the embassy in that last month before the evacuation? How were they preparing?
Well, there was an effort to begin to try to evacuate a lot of Vietnamese who had been really closely allied with the American war effort, and people who had worked in the embassy, people who had worked for the CIA, people who had worked for the military in some capacity. So the Ambassador Graham Martin, decided that he would implement a plan whereby he would fly Vietnamese and their families out in a f in a f in air in fixed wing aircraft while it was still they were still able to do that. So from April 1st to about April 25th, the U.S. Embassy managed to get about 37,000 Vietnamese out of the country. But that was just a fraction of the possibly 500,000 or so who actually worked for the Americans.
And we remember seeing those pictures of people lining up outside the embassy, trying to get into the embassy, trying to get out eventually.
Oh, yeah.
What was it like being amid all that chaos?
It was chaotic. I mean, it all started for me on the 29th of April. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning. I was, awakened from a really fitful sleep anyway because it was hot. The air conditioner wasn't working. We only had intermittent electricity in Saigon at the time. So around 4 o'clock in the morning, we came under a really heavy barrage of artillery and rocket attack. Most of it was on the outskirts of Saigon, and especially around Tan Son Nhut, which is the airbase. But a few made their way in toward the center of the town, and I remember, sitting up in my bed, and there was plaster falling off the ceilings along with a bunch of gecko lizards and everything else under the bed. And I thought to myself, this is not good. And I went out and looked out the window, and all the Home Guard troops, these are mostly teenagers in Saigon at the time, were running around shooting in the air, shooting anywhere, you know. And I hollered down at one of them because I knew some of them. I used to pay them to take me to the PTT office to file my stories after curfew, because there was a curfew on, and you didn't want to be out after curfew unless you were escorted. And I said, "What's going on?" And this kid named Na yelled up and says, "Boku VC, mini VC." I said, "What? Where?" He said, "Everywhere." And they were just shooting indiscriminately, and bullets were ricocheting off buildings. And I said, "This is absurd." You know, I'm getting back inside, and finally things calmed down. Obviously, the North Vietnamese were not in the city at that point. They were still way out. But that's a kind of panic that existed within the city. People were terrified. They thought for sure they were all going to be executed. And, you know, they were, because they were South Vietnamese.
Did it catch? It caught the embassy officials off guard too, I guess, right?
Yeah, I think that on that day, you know, see what had happened is we'd been pressing the embassy for weeks to tell us about the evacuation. What evacuation plans did you have in effect, and how would we be made? How would those be known to us? And so they said, "Well, we're going to do it by code." I said, "Well, what kind of a code?" And they said, "Well, we will broadcast over our FM station, which was a local station heard throughout Saigon, a weather forecast. It's 105 degrees, temperature's 105 degrees and rising, and then immediately followed by the first 8 bars of White Christmas," and which we thought was really kind of strange, but that was the way they wanted to do it. So we never heard that, by the way, because as soon as the final attack came, all bets were off, and we had known there were certain evacuation points where the press corps was supposed to go. And we went to the first one, and we couldn't go out of that one because it was a building on the Saigon River, which was above that building was another building, and on top of that building were 50 caliber machine guns facing right at the helipad. So we decided we're not going to go out from there. We better go someplace else, and we wandered around the city for about an hour. And finally, I went to the embassy. Thought I might be able to get into the embassy, but there must have been 20,000 people outside the embassy, you know, screaming and yelling and throwing things and trying to get over the wall. And I said, "I'm not going to get through that crowd," you know. In fact, I was embarrassed. I didn't want to be the American who goes, "Let me through. I'm going into the embassy," and all these Vietnamese were outside the wall. I just couldn't do that.
How eventually did you get out, and was your safety at risk as a journalist under the new regime?
Well, interestingly enough, you know, under the terms of the 1973 Paris Peace Accords, there was a kind of a little enclave out at Tonsonet Air Base called Camp Davis, which ironically was named after the first American killed in Vietnam. And this is where the Viet Cong were allowed to be, the National Liberation Front. And every Saturday they had a briefing. And we would go out as journalists to hear the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong talk about what was happening. And I remember asking this one colonel, a Colonel Ba. I said, "Colonel Ba," I said, "what if I decided to stay?" And he said, "Absolutely, you'd be perfectly fine. Just stay in your hotel. Somebody will come and get you." He says, "All those who are earning a, I guess, what did he say? Something like, all those who are earning a real living will be welcomed under the new regime." And so my feeling is I was going to stay. And when I told the Tribune that, I said I wanted to stay, and they said, "Absolutely not. We want you out. You know, it's a dismissible offense if you don't leave." You know, of course, I'm sure they wouldn't have fired me, but they wouldn't have been happy if I'd stayed. But at that point, when I saw what was happening and the chaos in the city and everything that was going on, I thought to myself, I should stay. And I'd gone back to the hotel room to get my, you know, to get stuff I needed to get out with. And when I walked into my hotel room, there was the room boy. I mean, he was a man who was 70 years old. Everybody called them boys. They were dressed in white cotton pants and coat, sweeping my room and, you know, doing like he'd always done. And I said, "Mr. Pham," his name is Mr. Pham. I said, "You should really leave and get out of here. It's going to be dangerous." And he said, "No, not to worry." He says, "I'm VC." And he was, and we'd known that a lot of the people who worked for the Continental Palace were, because the Continental Palace was a place that was never targeted by the Viet Cong. So we knew that they must have been paying them off or something, you know. And he was a very nice gentleman, and he suggested I should probably stay. And I said, "No, I've got to leave." And so I said, "Here, take everything I've got." And I gave him some money, and I left. But eventually what happened, we could not go out through the embassy, so we jumped on a bus, And the bus was an old military bus, and the Marine who was driving it said, "We're headed for Tanzanut, which is the airbase." The airbase at the time was under tremendous attack. I mean, just incredible. The 130 millimeter artillery shells landing on the runway. It was just a horrendous place to be going into. And I thought to myself, this is nuts. Why would I want to go out here? But it was the only place you could go because it was the only place that could, where these big CH-53 Sea Stallion heavy choppers could land. These are big helicopters that will carry about 75 people. And as we pulled up to the gate of Tanzanut, at least the military portion of the gate, the guards began shooting at our bus, or shooting over the bus, trying to make us go away. And we stopped and parked the bus, actually backed it up a little bit. And the Marine who was on board the bus with us had a two-way radio, and his code name was Wagon Master. And he yelled in the radio to the DAO compound, which is the Defense Attaché Office, is, "What should we be doing? What should we do?" And the guy says, "You know, I can't tell you." He says, I would just ram the gate and get through it. So the bus backed up, and the trounced the accelerator. The bus lurched forward. We were hitting about 60 miles an hour. We were all below the window wells. We didn't want to be above the windows. And I thought for sure we were going to get peppered. And inexplicably, as we got right to the gates, the guards threw the gates open. We went roaring through. I popped up, and to the left there was a helicopter that had just been shot down. We looked up in the air, and there was a C-119 taking off from the airfield. And I was really surprised to see this thing taking off because I don't know how the hell they got it up in the air. You know, because it was really, there were a lot of holes, craters everywhere on the runway. He gets up in the air, probably approaching 2,000 feet. And a SAM goes up and knocks it right down. And we see this thing get hit and fall right back into an area of Cholon, which was a sort of like the Chinese sector of Saigon. Of Saigon, excuse me.
Now, go ahead.
Well, as we headed for the DAO compound, which was called Pentagon East. Huge complex, very, you know, made out of reinforced concrete, enormously spread out all over the area there. And it was really the center of the military operation, the U.S. military operation in Vietnam. And as we drove up to the compound in our bus, the bus stops, and immediately a 122 rocket comes flying, hits the Air America terminal right across the road, and stuff is flying everywhere, and the bus is, you know, shaking. And then all of a sudden, about two more mortar rounds come flying in, and I'm still on the back of the bus. You know, there are 75 people on this bus that was built for about 50, and I'm trying to get out the back emergency door, but I couldn't get it open. I'm laying on my back kicking at it, and finally, you know, we finally get the thing to open, and just as I fall out of the back of the bus and get, I'm using the bus as cover, another mortar round comes in and hits about 45, 50 yards away. And I'm at that point, I'm running toward the DAO compound. And as soon as I heard this thing coming in, you can hear the incoming, I just spread eagle on the ground, and the whole place gets hit with shrapnel and glass and just concrete and everything else. And I got up and scuttled on inside after that. And we sat inside that building for about 2 or 3 hours inside the DAO compound waiting for a time when the choppers could actually come in and land and take us out.
But there was no assurance, I guess, that the choppers would get there at all.
No. Well, there were about eight Marines in there, and but they were part of the regular contingent assigned to Saigon at the time. And they came up and they began handing out tags, you know, and said, "Here, put your name on these." And, of course, I'd seen those tags before. That's what they put on body bags. And I knew they were giving us the tags because if something happened, they could identify us. You know, you were wired and you had to stick it between a buttonhole or something. And they said, "These are not for your luggage," they said. So, no, there was no, I didn't think, I mean, I was, I, in fact, I turned to a couple of guys and said, "You know, I think I'm going to walk back to Saigon. I'm going to walk back to town." It was 7 miles away. And I thought, this is ridiculous. We could sit out here forever, you know, and there's no guarantee we're going to get out of here. And besides, this place is under heavy attack. I mean, this place was being shelled continually, and the building was just shuddering all the time from this artillery outside. And I thought to myself, well, you know, eventually one of these things would come right on top of us, you know. It never happened, but it was very iffy. And after seeing that C-119 go down and that Huey, I thought to myself, do I really want to try to fly out of here, you know? But as it turns out, the North Vietnamese had given orders to the troops that when the evacuation started, that they were not to impede the evacuation in any way. They were not to shoot at the helicopters. They were not to try to knock down any of the choppers. And they didn't. And for what I can tell, they didn't. Even though my pilot said he had to drop 4 or 5 flares on the way out of Saigon because he thought that there might have been something fired at us. But I never saw anything.
Eventually, you did make it out.
Eventually, we got out. We got out to what they call a platform landing ship dock, and it was a ship called the USS Denver. And we landed on the deck of that thing, and for the next couple of hours watched just a steady stream of Hueys, hit choppers from, you know, Air America choppers, South Vietnamese Army choppers coming in and landing. And as soon as they would land, they'd push them over the side because they had no room for them. And at some point, they decided, we can't even let them land on the deck anymore. So they said, no, no, you can't land. So the choppers would fly near the carrier and tilt over, and they would open the door, and then he would move the stick in the other direction, and the chopper would tilt this way, and then he would jump out. And not only by themselves, but their families, children and women and everybody, jumping out of these choppers at, you know, 20, 25 feet up. And the chopper would peel off and go the other way, and they would fall this way. And sometimes I thought these people were not going to make it because the rotors came flying down into the water and hit within, you know, 5 or 15, 20 feet from these people. It was really, I couldn't believe it.
How many people eventually made it out on that day, are you aware of?
Yeah, there were about 1,300. There actually were 1,300, according to the official count, 1,373 Americans got out on the final day, and 5,680 Vietnamese got out on the final 24 hours.
And many were left behind.
And, oh, thousands were left behind. And, you know, that's the sad thing about it is, from an American point of view, I felt really guilty about it, you know. As a journalist, often you feel guilty when you're covering war or any kind of a catastrophe like that. I can't help feeling guilty because I know I can leave. You know, those people cannot. That's where they live. That's their home. They have no way of getting out. And I always knew I could come in there, do my work, and I could leave again and go back to something better. Those people had nothing to look forward to other than many of them prison. And they put them. They didn't call these things prison. They called them re-education camps. But when I went back again in '85, I think as many as 50,000-60,000 people were scattered around Vietnam in re-education camps. Still, 10 years later, doing hard labor.
How about today? How many of those families may still be around?
I think most of the. I mean, I think today, 30 years after the fact, it's no longer a factor. And you know, right now, around 60% or 65% of the population in Vietnam was born after 1975. So it's a very young population. When I was back in 1995 again for the 20th anniversary, what struck me most is the fact that so many Vietnamese are young. You know, really, it's a youthful population. Well, here's a country that lost probably half of its middle-aged population because of the war. You know, more than close to 3 or 4 million Vietnamese were killed during that war, and from both sides, North and South, civilians and soldiers. So it took a heavy toll on that population. And what happened, I think, now is that the country is, well, it's still under communist rule, but it's trying to develop its own market economy. And moving that in that direction, at least.
And 25, 30 years later, the United States is coming back in gradually. I believe there is an embassy there again.
Yes, there is. And I think it was in Hanoi, naturally, not in Saigon anymore, which Ho Chi Minh City. I can never call it Ho Chi Minh City. It'll always be Saigon to me. But Ho Chi Minh City is just a city in the south now. It's no longer a capital. However, it is the economic capital of Vietnam. There's no doubt about it. It's the... it's the center of commerce and finance. And it's the South Vietnamese have always been aggressively capitalistic in their approach to life, much more so than the North Vietnamese.
Have you been back recently?
95 was the last time I was back. I would like to go back again. I mean, it's always, to me, the last time I was back, I went back to about three different villages where I had been in 75 to see what had happened. And one of these villages, I was caught in the middle of a firefight between the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese. I was in the middle of a string of rice paddies, about 10 acres of them, and I was trying to get to the village, but we got caught in a crossfire. So we were lying in irrigation ditches while both sides were shooting over us, and I thought to myself, this could go on for hours, and as it turns out, it went on for about 20 minutes. And when finally the firing subsided, we took off running and got to a little river, went across the river in these little dugout boats, and then saw the results of this battle. There were probably 15 or 20 North Vietnamese soldiers who had been killed. They had been walking across a field that was mined with Claymore mines, and these things are anti-personnel mines that shoot 700 ball bearings in a 90-degree arc over, you know, 300 feet or so, and they're deadly. And so I wanted to go back to that village and see how that village had done. And I actually did, went back, and I talked to people who remember that battle and who remembered what had happened there. And, you know, it was really amazing that what we remember Vietnam much differently from the way the Vietnamese do. We remember it as, because we have a lot of guilty feelings about it, and we look at it differently. And I remember one old man telling me, he said, you know, I don't have time to think about the past. He says, that's 20 years ago. You know, that was 1995. And it's not important. What I have to deal with now is, you know, making sure my water buffalo are healthy and so I can plant rice and I can cultivate. But because if I don't do that, we can't live. So what's important to us is not the same thing that's important to you, you know. And it's very true. They've forgotten about it. He said, you know, that was then. It's just, you know, not important. Never mind, they say, you know. Not important, and that was then, and that's the attitude that you find in Vietnam today. There's not a lot of bitterness toward America. There's not any sense you are our enemies or whatever. I mean, the Vietnamese do call what we call the Vietnam War the American War, which I think is really interesting.
Hmm. Even though the Americans played a small part in what was essentially a civil war.
Yeah, well, they played a large part,
obviously, right. But.
It was a civil war, and it was not, you know, that was why, you know, that was the tough thing about being involved in it, because it was one of these situations where you look at why we were there, and I don't think a lot of people who went to Vietnam fully understood exactly why they were there. I mean, yes, the idea was, oh, we have to stop communism here, because if we don't, it'll be in Malaysia, it'll be in Singapore, it'll be in Indonesia, it'll be everywhere. And I guess if you look back and think about it in an objective way, perhaps, that it might have been a valid thing, because, look, there are no communist countries in the middle in Southeast Asia anymore except for Vietnam. But and ironically, that's the country we were trying to stop it in, you know.
Anything else to add? I'm going to have to wrap up, unfortunately, but, I mean—
Well,
it's something that many stories in what would seem like a short 5-month span in Vietnam, just so much that you keep from that experience.
Well, it's still vivid in my memory. Obviously, almost every minute of that last day, especially because, you know, when it was that intense, things like that stay with you. I think, you know, what I look back on now, and I look at at what happened. I think there are a couple of things which strike me. First of all, you know, Robert McNamara wrote a book in 1995 in which he essentially said, and he was the architect, one of the architects of the war in Vietnam, in which he essentially said, this is really unwinnable. And he knew it then. So my question is, why did they do this? Why did they send all these people to die there, all these Americans, 58,000 of them, 300,000 wounded? And it was McNamara who said, well, there's always light at the end of the tunnel. We're looking for light at the end of the tunnel. That was the famous phrase. And I remember standing on the deck of the USS Denver when all these choppers were flying in, and it was just a stunning kind of anticlimactic end to a very, very intense period. And I remember turning, there's nobody in particular, and saying, so this is what the light at the end of the tunnel looks like, you know, pretty bleak. And I went down and wrote my last story out of Vietnam.